You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For the first time in decades, new public health data reveals a rapid drop in drug overdose deaths across the nation. We look at what this positive development means for Wisconsin. That conversation is just ahead. Now on Wisconsin Today, new national surveys compiled by the CDC show a big drop in overdose deaths across the country.
Drug policy and addiction experts are searching for possible explanations for this development. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there was an unprecedented 10.6% decline in drug deaths for the 12-month period ending in April. That's compared to the same period in the previous year.
So what does this mean for Wisconsin? Dr. Julie Denier works with the Opioid Initiative for Emergency Medicine Specialists. That's a physician-owned practice serving multiple emergency departments throughout Wisconsin. Dr. Denier, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me, Kate. And it's great to be talking about something positive about opiates.
Oh, for once. And this isn't just a small drop after numbers were holding steady. It's a roughly 10% drop after numbers had been on the rise since 2018. What do you notice in your practice area in the Milwaukee area?
Well, we've been seeing exactly that. We don't have up-to-the-minute data. We can only just have a kind of a gestalt of how things are going in the emergency department. But it does seem like we're getting a little bit of a reprieve from the total number of people that are coming in, but we sure are still seeing people come into the emergency department on a regular basis with opiate overdoses.
Right. I mean, there are still like 100,000 overdose deaths a year, and that's, you know, 100,000 too many. What can we take away from that end of the sobering statistic?
Well, I'm a glass half full person, So I'd like to look at this as we're seeing a drop. And I think that we're seeing a drop, I'm hoping, because of all the initiatives that we've put in place. I have the pleasure of working in the emergency department since the 1990s when the opiate epidemic started. So I've seen it come from the very beginnings to the worst. It was just so tough in early 2019, 2020, and to 2022. Just so tough to see so many people coming in. But we have put a lot of practices into place in response to that. From the emergency department, I like to look at it. We treat these people in four ways. First and foremost, we've learned as emergency department providers that we're not prescribing as many opioids. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, you might have expected to get an opiate for a headache or a mild sprain. Mm-hmm. That is sure not the case anymore. We're also using other medications other than opiates when people are coming into the emergency department, using really, really fun nerve blocks, dental blocks, nerve blocks for headaches, so we don't have to treat people with opiates and take the chance of getting them addicted to that medication. We're also getting smarter about treating and referring people out and folding harm reduction into our practice. Everybody who comes into our emergency department has the ability to walk out with a free Narcan kit, which I think is huge about reducing the numbers of opiate deaths.
I want to pause right there on naloxone, also known by the brand name Narcan, and the opioid overdose reversal medication now being more accessible. We've seen the introduction in vending machines with free Narcan and Nalox boxes. We've just heard about the leave behind kits. What impact is all this having?
It is so difficult to really measure. In fact, when we started this initiative years ago, we thought, how can we best figure out if this is working? Because we give out free Narcan to people, but how do you measure a life saved or somebody not coming back to the emergency department? So we rely on just looking at the big numbers and saying there's a drop. I think the statistic is there's something like 85% of people who are using opiates have access to Narcan at this time, which is amazing. Yeah. And I really think there was initially five or so years ago, there was some stigma attached to giving out naloxone. And we've really learned that this is a life-saving medication that can get somebody to treatment, get them through that overdose and get them through treatment. I've just seen a big change on attitudes towards naloxone and just making it available everywhere. And I would really encourage people who are listening, if you have a way, if you go by a vending machine or you have access to naloxone, it's really smart to have a kit in your home. You never know what you're going to come across. I have a kit in my home and I have a kit in my car for if the need ever arises.
Talking with Dr. Julie Denier, works with the Opioid Initiative for Emergency Medicine Specialists in Wauwatosa. We're looking into the recent news that overdose deaths are down a lot around the country for the first time since 2018 and what this means for addressing the opioid crisis here in Wisconsin. Dr. Denier, according to the State Department of Health Services, Wisconsin is due to receive more than $750 million in total funding through 2038 as a result of the national legal settlements with opioid manufacturers and distributors. And last month on our show, we talked with KFF Health News correspondent Aniri Patani, who said she's encountered divergent views on how this opioid settlement money should be spent.
And so you have folks on one side saying we should only be giving money to first responders for things like harm reduction, like naloxone. People often know the brand name Narcan that they can give to someone who's had an overdose and revive them. And other people say, you know, we need to be funding everything that helps law enforcement with getting drugs off the street.
So as a healthcare provider, are you seeing the effects of the settlement money in the populations you serve? What is your feelings on this?
We have some amazing initiatives in the Milwaukee area, specifically. That's what I am most I'm most familiar with, that are grant funded. And we are also I'm working very closely with some grant funded opportunities. Specifically, we have a wonderful initiative of recovery coaches that come to our emergency departments. What that is we have a group of people who have lived experience with substance use disorder, who are on call 24 hours a day. And if somebody comes in with a need who needs to talk about substance use disorder, we make a call and they come to the emergency department and they talk to people about where they are in their substance use journey and see if they can assist them in any way. I think we all see this in different ways. I think this recovery coach initiative has been amazing. I've been a provider for a very long time, but I have never suffered with substance use disorder. So I feel like that was something I was lacking as a provider. I could go in and talk about substance use. I could talk about what I had to offer, but I even after all these years of working with people, I don't speak the language as well as I should. And there are a lot of patients that I'll go in and have a long conversation with and not make an impact with. And recovery coach can go in and just can be so more impactful because they can have a good conversation and speak the language. And that is a grant funded opportunity. Our naloxone kit and fentanyl strips are grant funded.
I want to ask you about recovery coaches, one aspect of resources in terms of recovery, but are you seeing shortages of inpatient and outpatient recovery resources? What is rehab like?
Where I see most of the paucity of care for people with substance use disorder is within the marginalized communities. Mm-hmm. Are in Milwaukee, that's going to be in the 53210 zip code. It's mostly in those communities that are more marginalized. We are slowly increasing our providers and access to treatment throughout Wisconsin, which is wonderful. We have a lot of providers who will prescribe naloxone now to, prescribe Suboxone to people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we really need to, as time goes on, really make sure that we're keeping our eye on those marginalized people and make sure that we have resources for them also. And we know that this grant money at some point is going to dry up. We have been able to get so many things off the ground, but to have these be sustainable, it's really important that hospital systems take this on as something that's important to them. Private insurance covers them, Medicaid, Medicare, to make sure that this, that substance use disorder is viewed as any other illness. Like if you have diabetes, you're going to get insulin. If you have substance use disorder, specifically opiate use disorder, you are going to get Suboxone. We need to see this as more of a medical illness and make sure that it's covered across the board. Because as this grant money dries up, we want to make sure these wonderful resources don't dry up.
Dr. Denier, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Julie Denier from Emergency Medicine Specialists in Wauwatosa. The practice services multiple emergency departments throughout Wisconsin. We've been talking about a big decline in drug overdose deaths nationally and what this could mean for efforts here in Wisconsin to address the opioid epidemic. If you or someone you know needs help or is struggling, go to findtreatment.gov. That's findtreatment.gov.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, fall is coming. That's a busy time on farms. Find out how farmers are dealing with weed control this time of year, including some high-tech solutions, plus some advice for gardeners.
The fall is the best time of year to try to control those perennial weeds, which many of us gardeners and those of us that have lawns tend to target.
That's next on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. Whether you're a gardener or a farmer, it's no secret, weeds can do a lot of damage to plants and crops.
Despite summer-like temperatures, fall begins this weekend, and this means farmers across the state will finish up the harvest, get ready for winter, and re-examine their approach to weed management.
From herbicide application to electronic weeding, Wisconsin farmers are using a lot of strategies to try and stay in control. Jerry Clark is the regional crops and soils educator for the Division of Extension at UW-Madison. He serves Chippewa, Dunn, and Eau Claire counties. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rob. Yeah, thanks for having me on today.
Now, for the non-farmers out there, they might think, okay, if we're worried about weeds, it might be spring and through the summer as crops are growing. What kind of stuff is going on with weed control in the fall and post-harvest?
Yeah, fall is a good time for farmers to be out scouting to see how this last season's program worked, whether that's a conventional farm or an organic farm. Fall is a good time to go scout fields as they're harvesting. They'll be looking at areas of the field that was there good control or poor control of specific weeds. And the fall of the year also is the best time to kind of look at that perennial weed control. We think of always doing weed control in the spring, but fall is an excellent time, actually the best time to control many of our perennial weeds, but also get a good idea of how a weed control program worked throughout this last growing season.
Now, we keep saying fall, Jerry. It starts this Sunday. Sure doesn't feel like fall in a lot of the state, up in the 80s, a lot of this month so far. How does that affect what we're doing in the fall on farms?
Yeah, we usually see some of those winter annuals that we can deal with. They'll set up shop this fall, such as a shepherd's purse is a common weed that's a winter annual. And when we have weather like this, it usually can get them to grow a little more aggressively in a vegetative state. They won't set flowers or start to set seed until spring, but many of the perennials and these winter annuals that we have can definitely get a little more robust in growing conditions like this. They do need extra water. I mean, that's just like any other plant. And so where we've had some dry conditions across much of Wisconsin, especially here in northwestern Wisconsin, we've seen a little bit more drier weather. Sometimes that can reduce the amount of seed output or any of that vegetative growth that some of these winter annuals will have, or these perennials that want to be a little more robust, they might be running out of water just like any other plant or crop that we have out there.
Jerry, I haven't looked at the numbers for the year yet. I'm guessing if we look at the season as a whole, it's going to look like, hey, average rainfall, except there's a lot in the first half and like almost none in the second half. What has that meant in terms of crops and weed control?
Exactly, Rob. It's been kind of a tale of two growing seasons all built into one here with that the really wet spring. And so we've had issues this spring with and early summer with that weed control that farmers have had to struggle to get either a herbicide on if they're more of a conventional producer, or if they're using an organic control, whether that's cultivation or some other type of control of weeds. This early spring was difficult because we want timely weed removal in the spring and early summer before that crop gets going. And we had that struggle this year. So many fields were weedier this year. And now that we get into the fall, we start to see those weeds still pulling some of that moisture out that we don't have a lot of. And that pulls away from the crop as it's trying to finish the grain production, whether that's corn or soybeans, or if we're in a forage or pasture situation, those weeds can still be an issue because they're competing for sunlight, nutrients, and water right up to the end of the freeze-up here.
When people think of weed control on a farm, they might first think of the herbicides you mentioned. How much spraying, how much herbicide use does there tend to be this part of the season?
This time of year, we don't see as much. The annual weed control has been pretty much implemented, whether that's a herbicide or a organic control such as cultivation. Those happen earlier, so we try to control those annual weeds throughout the early part of the growing season. In the fall like this, this is where we start to look at managing more of the perennial weeds looking at what the program was this last year for weed control. You're probably looking at herbicide usage for those perennial weeds, such as quackgrass, maybe dandelion, some of those perennials, whether they're broadleafs or grasses, that will be there in the spring. And fall is a good time to control some of those, especially in an older hay field, that alfalfa field or any kind of grassy hay field that's going to be rotated out of production. The fall is a good time of the year for that application of a non-selective herbicide. In the fall, you can use lower rates of a herbicide and probably just one pass of that herbicide application, so we don't need to come back a second time in the spring.
I know nature can be pretty crafty. How much do we worry about herbicide resistance, where, you know, that thing that used to be really effective against a particular weed, well, it's evolved a defense against it over time?
Yes, we've seen that in Wisconsin. We've got a number of herbicide-resistant weeds, both grasses and broadleaves. I think the one that we struggle with the most currently is water hemp. It's in the pigweed family, and pigweeds are very prolific producers of seed. So that's where we look at controlling that with different options. But yeah, you're absolutely right, Rob. We have overuse of some chemicals or some herbicides, and that has led to herbicide-resistant weeds. And what that means is farmers need to change their management program. They may need to rotate crops a little more quickly, or they need to add maybe that third or fourth crop to a crop rotation. Sometimes those kind of things can help. And also cover crops. That's something that we've seen a resurgence of cover crop usage here in the last 10 years. And there's options for cover crops to be used in terms of competition against weeds. And then farmers manage that cover crop in order to not compete with their normal cropping rotation.
I wanted to ask about cover crops, because over the years I've heard, you plant that crop, that post whatever you usually grow there, harvest crop, in part to fix the soil so it doesn't get washed off in that post-harvest rainstorm. Is it effective in outcompeting some of those perennial weeds that might pop up then?
Yes, we have seen that in several cases. Some of our UW research has shown that using something like a winter cereal rye, if you can get a ton or a ton and a half of biomass production out there in the spring, and then either terminating that or crimping that rye down so it competes and kind of provides a mat of cover, that can actually slow down weed emergence or eliminate it altogether. So we've seen the cover crop. Yes, you're right, Rob, is it is kind of looked at as a potential for erosion control, but it also is to build, you know, keep a living root within that system, within that soil structure. And then in the spring, having that built-in competition for weeds there. And again, a farmer does need to manage that cover crop as either cover and needs to remove that crop in the spring, or let it grow and harvest it as a harvestable crop, or if it's going to be used for hay or pasture or something like that.
Talking to Jerry Clark, regional crops and soils educator for the Division of Extension at UW-Madison. He works in western Wisconsin. Let's talk, Jerry, about some of the frontiers of weed control. You've been looking at this this weed zapper, basically electricity to control weeds. What's going on?
Yeah, so electronic or electric weed control is an option. We usually see it more in organic systems, but we have seen conventional farmers use it. It's basically a large copper bar that runs across the front of a tractor with a generator. The bar is set just above the crop, and any weeds that are above that canopy, once they come in contact with the bar, there is an electric voltage of 10 to 15,000 volts that go through this copper bar, and it basically burns or fries that weed with an electric jolt, and it kills off that top growing point of that weed. It gives the crop a chance to maybe grow above and start to canopy some of that soil, so future weeds aren't a problem.
Another technology you have your eye on, drones, aerial technology that collects some land data and then goes hunting for and spraying weeds. Is this a wave of the future, do you think?
The drone technology is emerging, and it's being used quite a bit on the pesticide side of things, specifically for fungicides. Where herbicides, we got to be very careful that it doesn't drift onto other plants or trees or crops or gardens where it shouldn't be targeted, and we can have much more injury from a herbicide misapplication than we can potentially with a fungicide application.
Maybe a dumb question here, Jerry. With AI, I'm skeptical about some uses of AI, but you know, being able to tell a crop from a weed, that seems doable. Are there mechanical uses for that? Maybe a rolling drone that can AI say, that's crop, I leave it alone, this is weed, I'm gonna cut it or pull it or something. Is that something we could see?
Yeah, I think that's a potential as you know, the crop depends on the size of the equipment. Of course, corn gets so much taller. That's where we have an issue with some of these machines being able to get into that crop canopy without injuring the crop from a mechanical standpoint, even from a chemical standpoint. So more of these shorter crops like where soybeans maybe aren't as tall or some of our vegetable crops, I think we could definitely see some robotic types of cultivation, weed removal types of systems, where we don't cultivate an entire field for weed removal. Maybe a shovel comes down, takes out that weed, and kind of moves its way across the field. So I think as we see robotics and artificial intelligence emerging, I think that's definitely on the table, along with what we're already seeing from kind of that spot spraying technology that's out there currently.
And Jerry, before I let you go, a lot of people out there might be thinking, well, I'm not a farmer, I got a garden. And I know one of our producers in this boat, they're wondering, what do I do in the fall? What should I be doing when it comes to anti-weed measures?
Sure. I think for gardeners, perennial weed management is always the fall is the best time for that. Whether you're dealing, again, with creeping Charlie, dandelions, some of the quack grass types of perennial weeds, this is a great time to mulch them, get them weeded out, stressing them out. Mowing is another cultural type of approach. Again, cover crops in a garden, putting something like oats or barley in there that's going to die over the winter and provide a mulch that's out there. Those are all opportunities now to keep those perennial weeds in those gardens and lawns under control. Also, if you are going to use chemicals, now is a good time to use those non-selective herbicides to spray those difficult weeds that might be causing a problem within the garden or in a lawn, especially some of those products for broadleaf control to kind of get rid of those. Again, the dandelions, maybe plantain, creeping Charlie, those kind of things. The fall is the best time of year to try to control those perennial weeds, which many of us gardeners and those of us that have lawns tend to target.
Jerry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
That was Jerry Clark, Regional Crops and Soils Educator for the Division of Extension at UW-Madison. He serves Chippewa, Dunn, and Eau Claire counties.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, an endurance swimmer has crossed all the Great Lakes and is attempting to conquer Lake Michigan again.
It's not an easy thing to do, to cross this huge puddle of water between our two states here. They call it a lake because it's freshwater, but make no mistake, it's an inland sea.
What it takes to swim for days on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last month, the ultra-marathon swimmer Jim Dreyer set out from Grand Haven, Michigan to swim more than 80 miles to Milwaukee, nonstop.
Dreyer was forced to turn back after his equipment was damaged 27 miles into his fourth attempt since August of last year.
In decades past, the 62-year-old endurance swimmer has crossed all the Great Lakes. Dreyer's latest attempts were to commemorate 25 years since his successful trek across Lake Michigan.
Jim Dreyer joins us to talk about his remarkable swims and plans for the future. Jim, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hello, Kate. I am very happy to be here.
Take us inside the goal of crossing Lake Michigan. What does that goal entail?
Well, I would say that goal is all-encompassing. It was 25 years ago in 1998 that I first swam across the lake and then went on to swim across all five Great Lakes, some of them in rather creative ways. But then last year in 2023, I realized, hey, this is the 25th anniversary of that first record crossing. You know, the only swim ever between Wisconsin and Michigan. And I thought, well, how am I going to commemorate this? So I thought, you know, hey, what if I swam again, you know, go back to where I started, Lake Michigan, and swim it again 25 years later, and this time go 25 miles further. And yes, 25 miles older also. 2023 was the year I turned this. I think I can say it. I turned 60.
You got it. You got it.
I'm coming to grips with it now, Kate. And so this goal started actually last summer. I made two attempts last summer. I made two attempts this summer. It's not an easy thing to do, to cross this huge puddle of water between our two states here. You know, they call it a lake because it's freshwater, but make no mistake, it's an inland sea.
You know these waters in a way that none of us ever will. I wonder, what is something we wouldn't know about the Great Lakes unless we'd be in your waters and we'd swim them?
I think the thing that people don't necessarily understand or realize is how the conditions can change out there so quickly. And when I say conditions, I mean waves, water temperatures, and what the conditions or the weather is like just a mile away. It can be completely different than where you're at. I mean, these lakes make their own weather.
You have to stay so lucid. What goes through your mind during a swim of that length?
Staying lucid is something easier to do earlier in the swim and not so easy to do later in the swim. As you get into that second night, at least for me, there's always some level of hallucinations that set in. When you get into the third night, if there is going to be a third night, the hallucinations get really, really bad. And so this is going to sound strange, probably, but I actually train for swimming through hallucinations. So when I'm doing my peak training, I always make sure I swim at least 2 days and two nights, because I know that second night the hallucinations are going to set in. And I train on a familiar course. That way I can interject logic against what my eyes are seeing and weigh the two. Because your eyes are going to see some crazy stuff, but being familiar with the course, I can interject logic and say, no, Jim, this is not real. It's okay to swim through that large pier that you see right in front of you because it's not there.
Wow. We're talking with Jim Dreyer, ultra marathon swimmer based in Michigan, as we look at his recent attempt to swim more than 80 miles from Grand Rapids, Michigan to Milwaukee. Jim, what about nutrition? How do you keep yourself fueled at a, you know, trying to go a distance like that?
Yeah, you know, I can tell people I've got a great weight loss plan, but there's probably easier ways to lose the weight. For instance, when I successfully swam across Lake Superior, I took in more than 60,000 calories and I still lost weight. So right now I tend to feed about every 2 hours and I take in at least 350 calories. I take a meal replacement drink. That's 350 calories. But once in a while, I'll also add some granola or I'll just take a mouthful of pure honey. Just, you know, for the energy. Sometimes I'll take a mouthful of olive oil for the omega-3 fats. Well, all of that stuff also has a lot of calories. So when you add it up, you know, 60,000 calories for a 3-day swim is pretty close to what I'm taking in. And I still lose weight, you know, I mean, and I don't have that much fat to lose. So you start losing muscle tissue. Your body starts cannibalizing itself. So, you know, the clock is ticking, you're using up more than you're taking in. And so, you know, you just hope there's enough in the tank to get through.
So after your latest attempt to cross Michigan, you said your next attempt would be in 2027 when you'd be 64. Are you concerned that you may not be able to make it across Michigan again?
Well, you know, that is a possibility. You know, the Beatles have a song about turning 64, you know, and the lyrics are, will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Well, I hope so. And I mean, right now I feel great. I mean, I really have no negative physical effects from these two swims this summer. I mean, physically, I was fine. My problems were with the navigation, and that's a whole other story. Navigational issues is what forced me from the water both times. And the first one was also fueled by hallucinations. But so hopefully I'm still, you know, feeling great in 2027. I'm going to keep training. I'm going to keep dreaming. I'm going to keep hoping and praying. But, you know, I have an obligation in 2025. And this is a whole nother story. But 2025 is the 50th anniversary of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And we're probably all aware of Gordon Lightfoot's song, mm-hmm. you know, telling that story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm organizing a 411-mile relay swim. 68 swimmers are going to swim from the point of where the shipwreck lies in Lake Superior to Detroit, which was the Edmund Fitzgerald's intended destination. And it's a way to forever memorialize these 29 mariners who lost their lives. And we're also raising funds to preserve a very important lighthouse up there to safeguard mariners of today and tomorrow. So I'm committed to that next year. So 2025 is going to be out. 2026, I'm also going to be launching a swimming-related endeavor I can't talk about yet. I would love to get back to my own swim before 2027, but I don't see how I'm going to be able to do it before then.
Jim, I want to land on whether you have any advice for someone who's listening to this who would love to be an open water endurance swimmer and do the things that you do.
Well, first of all, you can feel free to contact me. I've most swimmers who, at least who are interested in swimming the Great Lakes, they end up contacting me, and I'm always happy to help and just pass on what I learned. So I'm very happy to share and want you to be successful. Second of all, you can do this. You know, I mean, you have to take it in, just like any goal, you have to take it in bite-sized pieces. You have to walk before you can run. Or in this case, you have to crawl before you can, you know, swim across a great lake. But I think it can be, you know, it is a doable thing. I've certainly proven that. And so you do have to believe in yourself. You have to get out there in the open water. You can get a lot of good training in the pool. You can get a lot of speed work in the pool, some good swimming specific strength training in the pool. And I can tell you how to do that. I do that in a rather unique way. I pull a 20-gallon bucket underwater and put large paddles on my hands and forearms, and I do sprints with that. It is incredible strength training that's very swimming specific. But eventually you have to get out in the open water where there's no lane lines, where you're affected by the waves and you're affected by the weather and the water temperatures. And you have to put in a lot of time out there because the open water is a completely different animal than the pool. Mm.
Jim, what an inspiration. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Kate. Anytime.
Jim Dreyer is an ultra marathon swimmer who's aiming to cross Lake Michigan again for the first time in more than 25 years.